Welcome to the ThinkSpace podcast with myself, John Stoskowski, and Danny Massaro. Our goal with this podcast is a simple one. We discuss and dissect a prescient topic, issue, or theme that we think is interesting and might help us humans better understand why we think, feel, and do what we do. If you'd like to engage in these types of conversations too, you can check out thinkspace.academy for a unique cohort-based course that will help you think critically and live authentically. Hope you enjoy the episode. Right, so this episode, Danny,
yes,
we're going to be talking about one of our, she's come up a lot actually on the podcast over the different episodes that we've done, but she's probably one of our favourite people that we've mentioned so far, certainly in your PhD and the stuff that you've done, Simone de Beauvoir. And she was one of the 20th century existentialist philosophers in France, lived from 1908 to 1986, and she was the life partner of Jean-Paul Sartre, who we've talked about again quite a lot in a few of the different episodes that we've done. And what we're going to focus on today is one part of her body of work, really, which is a book called The Ethics of Ambiguity. A lot of what de Beauvoir was getting at with this book, what concerns freedom, essentially, and what it means to be free. So when we're kids, we're basically thrown into the world, and then basically we just see all the adults around us giving us values, giving us meaning, giving us rules and regulations to follow. And we tend to see those adults as, you know, the be-all and end-all of just everything that is objective and true and real. And we see them as like just knowing everything. So I'm sure everyone can think about when they were a kid, you thought that your parents were gods, basically, and they knew everything, and everything they said was true and was correct, and they knew what they were doing in life, basically. So as kids, we are pretty free in that sense, or we feel pretty free. The world tends to make sense, doesn't it? And we're just inhabiting this world where we just play around and let the adults kind of look after the serious stuff. As we reach adolescence, this is where de Beauvoir said, basically, the penny starts to drop and you start to realize, actually, there isn't all this objective meaning and all this objective, these objective rules and values and stuff. You've actually got a hell of a lot of freedom in coming up with your own values, a hell of a lot of freedom in deciding how you are going to go about living your life.
Yeah, so when you're a child, basically, she says, all your job is to get up in the morning and be a child. So you're happily, she says, you're a happily irresponsible being. You think your parents got everything stitched up, like they've been to, you know, the best university ever on how to be a parent. You believe that they are almost like gods to you. You know, they know everything about everything, and all you've got to do is be under their wing in a way, get looked after, get up, make some friends, and carry on. And we all know that feeling that when you're getting towards later teenage years, although when you're a child you start to, you know, want to grow up so you can do some adult things, what equally starts to happen are the questions that are coming along, such as, what are you going to be when you grow up? What are you taking at college? Are you going to university? How are you maybe going to earn money? You know, what are you going to do with your life? Are you going, you know, and basically the innocence and the naivety of just basically getting up and being a kid and, you know, just do it, you know, no responsibilities beyond practical things, suddenly that opens right up. And therefore, she said, we nostalgically love to want to go back to being a kid. You know, there's a lot of us, we want not necessarily to be that age and so on, but we want the feeling of the non-ambiguous state of just being here. We don't want to think, gosh, right, I've really got to make something of myself, which is, you know, the sort of transcendent part. I am what I am. I am what I am not yet. So, yeah, I am a person and this is my life. But what starts to come in more is, you know, what are you going to become something better? Are you going to move on? How are you going to grow? Where are you going to live? So all these responsibilities start coming on. So that's it, really.
A word that comes to mind for me, and I think she does actually use in the book, is that sense of loss. Mm. So we tend to feel, you do a little bit, don't you? You feel like you've lost your childhood. So when you hit a certain age, it's something that's gone and you can never get it back, and you've lost that essence of being a child.
Yeah, I think it's not something you don't appreciate any of this when you're younger, do you? You're not thinking like we're thinking now. But you might look back in years and, you know, when you're older and reflect that, oh, I lost my childhood. I lost the innocence of it. They were the years that were, you know, these sort of things happen, and that's why there is a nostalgia for going back to those days. But I think one of the films that came to mind when I was reading it was the film Stand By Me. It's a film where there's a man reflecting on his kind of last ever youthful, spirited, childish journey. You know, when they go to search for the dead body along the train tracks. And the film resonates with so many people because it reminds you of what it was like to go on those little adventures as a kid, where you were getting in trouble, you were getting chased, you were telling ghost stories, you know, and it was almost like that film, you know, as they conclude, it was like the last time those boys did it. So it was a poignant moment for them, because it was like after that, when they all said goodbye to each other, it was almost like they didn't see each other much again. They went to college and that was the end of their youth. And that's a good, I always think of that bit, you know, those moments where really, you know, your future opens up really, really dramatically, and it needs filling in.
You definitely see, or certainly I do, it feels inherently like a simple time, doesn't it? When you think back to if I think back to summers at school, and it just felt like your days were just brilliant, packed with stuff, but it was such a simple time. It was like, get up, right, it's sunny, what am I doing today? And it was, yeah, you had choice, but it was very simple in that it's like, eat at certain times, you know, make sure you had your bike, make sure you knew what time you were coming round to meet them, and then we were doing whatever. It was a simple time, wasn't it? But I think when you think about it now, when we're talking about it this way, it was just simple in that we didn't have like serious choices to make, did we? Am I going to have a donut with my lunch, or am I going to have a pot noodle?
One of the lines I have underlined in the book, you know, my copy, is he can, if he likes, be lazy. His whims and his faults concern only him. They do not weigh upon the earth. They cannot make a dent in the serene order of a world which existed before him, without him, where he is in a state of security by virtue of his very insignificance. He can do with impunity whatever he likes. He knows that nothing can never happen through him. Everything is already given. His acts really engage nothing, not even himself. That's great writing, I think. And it's like, yeah, you don't think you're significant. You don't think the world really could ever change because of you. You're not political. You're not, you know, when you see a young kid who is like political and opinionated and all that, you just think, shut up. You know, it's like, you're too mature. You're not having a childhood. You're a kid. Be a kid. You know what I mean? And it's like they've copied being mature. Now, the irony is that, like, why do we actually need to lose that? Why? What de Beauvoir's saying is you have to get going, you know, you have to get on with responsibilities. But ultimately, people have cooked up strategies so that they can almost get rid of the ambiguity which comes. And the ambiguity, like you said, is, you know, the kid obviously feels like they're just an object in the world, and they're not, you know, they're just getting on with whatever they get on with. But as you get older, you feel a bit more like you're a subject and you've got projects and you have to do things, and you start thinking about yourself more. You probably start playing out, starting the movie of my life, my whole existence. You know, you probably start looking around you more at, you know, people at your age and where society's going and how you're going to navigate it and fit in. You know, what career are you going to take? What kind of, you know, finances are you going to be bringing in? Are you going to get a life partner? All these, like I said, that your future opens up and it starts to be anxious. So when I'm working a lot with athletes and people I help, this stuff about this pressure, you know, in like from junior transition to senior transition, it kind of happens with that. You know, if we were looking, like we were talking a bit about, like someone like Emma Raducanu, who was just like basically a kid playing tennis last year, just hitting balls, having a laugh. You could see it all over her. She surprised everybody through that youthful naivety and exuberance. She cracks on, freakily wins the US Open for whatever reasons, has a great week, gets on a run. And then all of a sudden, you know, she is a different person. It's not necessarily because she's become a bad person, because she's been seen too many sponsors and taking all the money and so on. Just the fact it probably propelled her in a naivety to, she's all the spotlight on her, and now it's like, oh, I am somebody, and I am significant in the world. I have affected so much. And it's very hard for her to go back to being the child. She probably, so therefore, in some ways, she probably wishes she hadn't won the US Open in a small way, in an existential way, because it's brought on all these expectations and shoulds that she now should be doing because she's at that standard. So if she loses matches, if she doesn't play well, if she changes coaches, everyone's now got an opinion on her, and it's almost as if immediately she should have the wisdom of a 50-year-old being.
That definitely comes across in press conferences, doesn't it? So that, like, that feeling of as a kid, you said about politics there. If someone asked you about your view on some political thing as a 9-year-old, you wouldn't even have a clue like what it was, or you wouldn't be expected to have an opinion. Whereas now she's in that phase, isn't where they're asking her stuff in press conferences that she can't just fall back on what her parents' values were, or what her parents maybe have coached her to even say, or that it's like you're in the moment, aren't you? It's like, no, you've got to have your opinion now. Like, and it's ambiguous. There is no right answer to this question, but I'm going to ask you, and you've got to say something because you're on camera.
And it's always future related. Who's your next coach? What are you hoping to achieve? What do you think success will look like for you? Will you win next week? Are you injured because you're playing next week? So are you going to? So everything all of a sudden is quite serious. Everything has a consequence. And she's like, it's very hard for her to just say, I'm just hitting tennis balls and playing people that I happen to draw myself against. That doesn't cut it in the adult world. So the innocence has kind of gone. You know, that's an example of what we all go through in many ways. But Simone de Beauvoir suggested that to get out of that, we quickly adopt little strategies to say, no, I'm not going to get into that. I'm just going to be this kind of person, and therefore I don't have to engage with my freedom. Because essentially what it is, it's you get older and you're aware that you are free to make choices all the time.
The word that she uses is we're condemned, aren't we? We are condemned. Yeah. Which again is a lot of what Sartre was talking about. You know, we're condemned to be free.
Which is great because you're free, you can make choices, but it's like, wow, I've got to make all the choices, you know, me. And it's like, what's your ability? How good are you at doing those choices? Whilst at the same time, you're making them choices, but you also know that the world acts on you. So you're in certain cultures, look can happen, you know, absurd things can come along. You can be in a certain country, a time and a place, and opportunities can come along and opportunities might not come along and so on. So the world acts on you, but you've got to act back. And it's in that, like, well, how much of what's going on in my life is my fault, and how much of it is it just was always going to happen to me anyway? And also, am I about me? Is this all about me? It's like selfish. Is this all about me and my survival? Am I, you know, or is it about everybody else? So am I a member of a team here in the, or am I an individual? That's one of the dualities that, there were many dualities that Simone de Beauvoir said, we get under all these tensions, you know, am I young or am I old? You know, I'm 21. Does that mean I'm old or am I young? And it's like, well, you know, that's another duality that you kind of wrestle with in your mind. Like, oh, I'm getting old now. So, no, I'm still young. No, you're not. You're too old. You've passed it. So these dualities play on you. So she was quite perceptive because she was like, she was onto these background existential sort of everydayness feelings that you kind of have. And when I work with athletes as well, when I bring these types of things up with them, they've never thought about them consciously, but they're like, wow, yeah, that's exactly what it feels like. But they haven't learned it at school or anything like that. So you can help people just by making them aware of it. Yeah, you're going a little bit nuts. You're a bit under pressure. Life's not quite as simple as it was 3 years ago. You're feeling a little bit like, whoa, you know, and you're trying to avoid it by maybe just going on an endless holiday or hiding in university for 10 years. or doing a gap year or what, you know, you're probably trying to keep, you're trying to shut out that big existential future that's opening up that you have to fill in meaningfully. So, you know, you've done your degree, now you've done a master's, fine. You know, like you're going to have to go into the world at some point. All right, you're having a year out. Oh, you know, you're doing a year teacher training. That's another guest pass, you know, another free pass for a year. But eventually you're going to have to be in the big wide world. What are you going to do with no story to say, oh, I am just this? And this is where it gets interesting, because this is where de Beauvoir says, right, one of the, you know, the first thing that people do to try and escape that is this. And she called that the sub-man, didn't she?
Yeah, so this is very much part two of the book. That again, short chapter, it really focuses on this, and this is where she presents these five different ways, or five characters really, that people use to try and deny this freedom that they've now got. So they've gone through childhood, they realise, God, I've got all these possibilities ahead of me now, and it's really ambiguous. These are the five different ways that they can potentially try and deny that freedom. And they go essentially from least to most free. So we'll start with the subman that you mentioned then, and it moves on up this ladder of freedom, really, towards most freedom. We've got the subman that Danny mentioned. The next one up from that is the serious man. The next level up from that is the nihilist. Then we have the adventurer. And then the final, or the fifth one, is the passionate man. They're the five different stages that de Beauvoir outlined. So we'll start with the subman, which she saw really is the worst possible response to this dilemma that you've got now, with having all this freedom ahead of you and all this ambiguity and choice that you've got. And de Beauvoir said the worst thing that you can do is become a subman. And just to try and summarize it a little bit, and then we'll unpick it. The subman basically is afraid of action and its consequences. So he basically just does nothing at all. And the subman basically is treating himself as a bit of an object. So he sees himself as an inanimate object that doesn't really take much responsibility for his actions. She saw submen as trying to reject their own freedom and just hide from the world. Often that was because they just fear the consequences and the responsibility that come with action. So it's almost like, well, you know, I'm not going to do anything. I'll just stay in the house, not speak to anyone, not do anything. And I can't really face any consequences then from not doing anything. Subman is far from freedom through the ongoing refusal to take ownership of his existence in the world. To avoid being disappointed, or to avoid disappointment, they just avoid engaging in anything. So if he doesn't try, he can't fail. You know, that's the best way to be as the subman. That's how the subman would view himself. The subman decided long ago that everything in the world is insignificant and dull. And that ends up, because they don't do anything, because they don't want to fail, that ends up becoming a self-fulfilling prophecy. So instead of facing up to the challenge of the free will that they've got, they just hide from it. So the subman is kind of that mopey, apathetic person who can, I don't know, stand in front of the Colosseum in Rome and just remain unimpressed. You know, like anything that's beautiful or impressive to other people, they just see that and go, yeah, it's, you know, it's all rubbish. So that's the subman.
Yeah, I mean, it's like a low state of motivation as well. So you're in the world, but you're sort of like almost pure facticity. It's like, I am what I am. I'm not going to take part in my, you know, transcendence. I'm not bothered about what I become. I'm happy being here, doing this, playing on my computer games, whatever it is, hanging around here, plodding, and I'm not engaging really with any future projects. So you're literally just taking up space, you know, and eating, sleeping, existing, you know, but you've denied your ambiguity of I am what I am not yet. You're just like, I am what I am, leave me alone.
Yeah.
That's essentially it. So you can obviously, therefore, you could get depression, and you can, you know, you don't want, nothing excites you. You don't really think that anything's worth doing too much, you know, in terms of developing yourself, because you know, you are what you are, and what can you do about it? And if anyone starts going at you, say, well, you could try this, and you could get your hair cut, and you could leave this room, or you could get a new job, and you could tidy yourself up, you could get fit, and you could start eating better, and you could, you know, spend a bit less time on your phone and less time on the computer screen and watching box sets, and you could move out of your mum's house. Come on, you're 68 now. You know, this type of thing, they're like, nah, I'm fine, just leave me. Which, you know, is the extreme opposite to some of the later things where everybody goes full transcendence and gets lost in that, or to way, way too goal-orientated and future-oriented.
Next up from that, and this is probably the most common way that people deny the freedom, is the serious man. Now, this is where basically to solve the kind of existential crisis that you find yourself in with all that freedom that you now realise you've got, they'll essentially just choose some arbitrary object or system that defines their values for them. So that might be things like, you know, religious fanatics. She talks about like company bosses, like CEOs and stuff like that, who might start defining the self-worth with money and things like that. But like the subman, the serious man is trying to deny their own freedom. And that rather than just giving up like the subman does and resorting to the facticity, the serious man does that by choosing and adhering to a set of fixed values that come from somewhere else. And they take comfort in letting that external value system basically just dominate the way of thinking. They're essentially outsourcing their thinking to something else, a set of rules, a set of values that someone else gives them, and they just decide to live by that and they take comfort in that. So they're dedicating their life to and their energies to some cause, maybe an idol. You know, it might be a political party. It could be a football team, I suppose, where you just go, right, I'm now a fan of this team and this guides my life. Every week I'm just following this team and I do what fans of that team do. So they're believing for belief's sake. That's what she says in the book. The serious man believes for belief's sake, just so he does not have to confront the responsibility of choosing beliefs based on his own independent thoughts.
So basically, it's a bit like Sartre's bad faith, okay?
Yeah.
So you might be like, you might be 18 and you're right, well, I'm going to get, you know, 20, I'm going to get into this pop group and I'm going to listen to all the lyrics and buy all the clothes and dress like them. And now, oh, but I didn't realise I'm now in this group. I'm a punk or I'm a goth. And basically you're not a person anymore. You're a punk or you're a goth or a raver, right? And everything just becomes like, well, I'm a full-time, that's what I do now, I'm a raver. So what, it's not my choice, you just follow this code. What we do, we go out every weekend and we wear these clothes and we dance till this time and we do, you know what I mean? So you find some rules to follow and you just basically think that is the key to everything and that's what you become. So, you know, one of them, this de Beauvoir says, he makes himself serious. He dissimulates his subjectivity under the shield of rights, which emanate from the ethical universe recognized by him. So he's no longer a man, but a father or a boss or the member of a Christian church or the Communist Party. So in other words, I am now this. That's me. You know, I am doing, I'm a student. That's another one. You know, I'm a student. And you can't say anything because I'm a student. And it's a little bit like I'm a serious student. So I get this with athletes. Again, I'm a professional player now. And they start, you know, they basically, it's like, it's good in a way because there's these already established rules that all you've got to do is follow them. And again, that takes away the ambiguity to think for yourself and be broader than the title that you become. Now, a lot of people never get past that, do they? They'll be there, I am an artist, I am a teacher, I am, you know me, I'm a stay-at-home mum, you know, and it's done. I'm doing it in that serious tone because that's what it's like. The flexibility isn't there to actually maybe, well, I am a bit of that and I'm a bit of that and I do that, but I'm not really, you know, it gets rid of the ambiguity because you become a staunch representation of those rules. And it's kind of an easy life, really, because all you've got to do is be that.
And I think that because those constructs really are exterior,
yes,
a key part of the serious man to me is they essentially believe that those constructs are universal.
Yeah.
So it's like, you should think that way as well. You should believe this and you should value this as well. They take the subjectivity for other people out of it. So it's like, you know, I'm a conservative voter. So the values of the Conservative Party or the Tory Party are this, and everyone in the country should, you know, this should be universal. Yeah. They should be in government and everyone should believe the same things and value the same thing.
Yeah, it starts off like, you know, oh, I'm not eating chicken, I'm not having meat. And then all of a sudden they're like, you're on a march, a veganism march, and they can't come to your house because they say that you've had dead animals there. You know, it becomes very fundamental and I cannot believe that, you know, you're not living this way. It's surely the way to go. you know, in terms of if it was politically like that. But in other ways, a serious man is like, if you were a teacher and you were you had a certain method of teaching, right? You would be like, all teachers should teach this way, because this is ultimately the way. This is what teachers are. This is the way to do it. And whereas we get later on, you know, such, you can be quite passionate, you know, about something, but you don't think that it's for everybody, but it can still be a bit of a trap. And that's the serious person. And I think we all know people like that, and we can also recognize it in yourselves. So I think these caricatures, it's not like you're in them all the time. You sort of can float about into them and back and forth, but you kind of probably hover in one, a bit like we used with Nietzsche's episode last week. But I can definitely recognize times in my life and times now where I jump into that serious mode, and I'll go like, well, at the end of the day, blah, you know, everyone should be doing this. And it's like, whoa, I've gone back into my like mode there, a serious bit. And again, I always obviously talk about players and athletes. When I recognize that they've gone a bit too serious and stuck in, you know, I'm a professional athlete and this is what professionals do, they become very rigid. It can be useful because it's productive and you get things done, but existentially, you're denying ambiguity. So when the ambiguity actually comes along, when life actually is ambiguous and other things come in, and it, you know, you have to think about stuff, you become inflexible, and you can end up in some bad states because you've basically been too rigid.
Well, it's interesting because de Beauvoir said this is probably, you know, this is the most common, probably the most common of the five levels. Yeah. And she was essentially saying that this almost guarantees you a life of unhappiness.
Yes.
You know, you're basically in for a time just perpetual unhappiness if you assume this role of the serious man. So she says in the book, everything is a threat to him, since the thing which he has set up as an idol is an externality and is thus in relationship with the whole universe. And since, despite all precautions, he will never be the master of this exterior world to which he has consented to submit, he will be constantly upset by the uncontrollable course of events.
Yeah, that's it.
And it does, that resonates with the current, you know, the way society is at the minute. There's a lot of anxiety, there's a lot of depression and mental health issues going on in a lot of people. And, you know, I don't think it's a coincidence that a lot of people have assumed this role of the...
This was another great bit. He keeps himself from existing because he's not capable of existing without a guarantee. Proust observed with astonishment that a great doctor or a great professor often shows himself outside of his speciality to be lacking in sensitivity, intelligence, and humanity. The reason for this is that having abdicated his freedom, he has nothing else left but his techniques. In domains where his techniques are not applicable, he either adheres to the most ordinary of values or fulfills himself as a flight. The serious man stubbornly engulfs his transcendence in the object, which bars the horizon and bolts the sky, and the rest of the world becomes a faceless desert. Now, I've seen people get like that with they get so stuck in their, you know, profession. Like she says, for example, if there is being only, for example, in the form of the army, how could the military man wish for anything else than multiple barracks and maneuvers and possibly a war? So how can you survive in the world if you know, if you've been a really serious athlete, you know, how can you survive when you're not an athlete anymore? If you've been, you know, a teacher or a magician or something like that, how can you go and survive in other places? You've been so stuck in that one area, you're a one-trick pony, and therefore you're a bit, you know, you're a bit bland. You've only shone your light in one area, and out of that area you're very uncomfortable, so you want to be in there all the time. Like people, you know, when you go out for a night out and they can't stop talking about work, that type of stuff, or become a parent and they can't stop talking about kids. Have you not got anything else in your repertoire than just that? Does it consume you that much? And that's when you can tell someone's got stuck in the serious mode.
Yeah. And she said what happens is when they fail to realize their goals, essentially, serious men, what they can do is then they'll either go back to the subman and revert back to that, or she says they can turn into nihilists, which is the next level. So she says of that, conscious of being unable to be anything, man then decides to be nothing. So So, and we did an episode on sunny nihilism, didn't we? So, you know, I think people will probably be more familiar with this one and what nihilism is. But, you know, this is where usually I suppose the meme is like you find it in teenagers, don't you? So they've lost that idyllic childhood state that we talked about. And they just go, oh, what's the point? You know, the mopey teenager, what's the point? Nothing, you know, there is no point to anything kind of thing. But she was saying it can pop up in midlife. So this is maybe a midlife crisis type of phase, I suppose, where someone's tried to be serious and they failed. So they tried the serious man. They realized that there's no pot at the end of the rainbow. And then they kind of seen it as a failure. And then it's just they revert into nihilism. So this is where the nihilist accepts that there is no absolute moral values. And they kind of end up pursuing a will to destruction then. So it can become, you know, it's about disorder and anarchy. In a way to show other people that the values are just made up and there's no point, there is no inherent meaning to life and all that stuff. So that it can be quite destructive nihilism in that sense.
Yeah, for me, this was like, I took this as a tantrum. You know, it's a massive tantrum with the world. You know, it's like, oh, you know, because it's ambiguous and it's like things aren't.
I think it's good in that way. Because you basically accept it, you understand that life is ambiguous, so that's a positive of the nihilist, isn't it?
Yeah, there's no, the nihilist is well, nothing's really worth anything because it's so ambiguous and it's so, the world acts on us so much, that what can you do about it? You know, it's not like, you know, as you notice these things, they go like no action towards action, back to no action towards action type thing. And I think that the nihilist tries to deny the fact that they can actually make a difference. The nihilist likes to go, well, like, unlike there's energy there. It's not like the subman where they completely give up, but they kind of actively go around being like,
destroy you.
Yeah, I'm just going to be causing a bit of anarchy and telling everybody that nothing means anything and bringing everybody else's projects and where they live down. Poking holes and being, you know, being high at the high end of skepticism and the high end of cynicism, but actually, you know, denies that there is a point to life, that you do still have to take part. You know, because you've got freedom. What de Beauvoir was saying, the existentialist, you've got to constantly make choices and you've got to basically face the ambiguity and try and ride it as you go along in positive and negative ways, in moral ways, ethical ways. But the nihilist is like, no, I ain't doing that. I'm basically, the whole world's this. This can happen and this can happen. And you're foolish to be optimistic in some ways because it's all a load of rubbish and, you know, there's not a lot of meaning in anything. So it's kind of like, it's not depressing as in there's no energy depression. Like the subman can get, you know, I'm really apathetic. It's almost like a tantrum with the world. It's almost a bit angry. It's almost a bit, it's like a fun pointlessness. And it's like you like bringing people down and prodding and provoking. You kind of give up, but you still, the problem with a nihilist is you're still here and you've still got to deal with yourself. You can be as nihilistic as you want. And I love catching a nihilist who actually ends up finding a little bit of fun one day or a bit of love or a bit of meaning.
Is that not where the adventurer comes in? So de Beauvoir basically says, you know, in no uncertain terms, you know, the nihilist can basically, it's like, well, if you think that, you may as well just give up and commit suicide, you know, if you're at that point. Or, like you've just alluded to there, it's like, no, you can become the adventurer. So the adventurer is almost like that upbeat, optimistic version of the nihilist.
Yeah.
So they recognize the ambiguity, and rather than rejecting the freedom to live it anyway, they grab it and go, no, I am going to live then. So it's ambiguous, but I've got the freedom to choose. So I'm going to like crack on and do what I want to do now and kind of live the life I want to live. So that's the adventurer that she talks about, where they still know that there is no real kind of ultimate meaning to life. They're a bit more hedonistic, I suppose, aren't they? They just kind of embrace it and go, right, whatever I'm into, whatever floats my boat, what makes me curious, what are the opportunities that I've got in front of me? And they just kind of dive into it a little bit and embrace that aspect of existentialism.
Yeah.
And this is akin to, really, so the episode that we did on Nietzsche's The Camel, the Lion and the Child, this is almost on a par with Nietzsche's child stage in that three-stage model that he had. So de Beauvoir says, you know, the adventurer, he throws himself into his undertakings with zest, into exploration, conquest, war, speculation, love, politics, but he does not attach himself to the end at which he aims, only to his conquest.
He likes action for its own sake, finds joy in spreading through the world a freedom which remains indifferent to its context.
So it's all about project, isn't it? It's just embracing your freedom, right? What are the projects I want to get into? What makes me want to get up on a morning? And they just go full steam ahead and crack on with that. And de Beauvoir was saying that the adventurer is actually quite close to that genuinely moral attitude where they're just embracing life and they're the captain of their own ship and they're getting on with it.
Yeah, and she says that whether the taste for this adventure appears to be based on the nihilistic despair, you know, as to get away from the despair of nihilism as well, oh, let's just go and have some bloody fun, right? Or whether it's born directly from the experience of the happy days of childhood, like, right, I want to be adventurous and get back to being a kid.
Yeah.
You know, this, you know, I'm just go, you know, it's my, I'm going to just go for things and take risks and I'm going to go after my pleasures, really, and my desires. It always implies that that freedom is realized as an independence in regard to the serious world. Basically, that it's a selfish thing, though. It's kind of like the adventurer denies the ambiguity by going full on selfish, and it's like Nietzsche's Übermensch. It's like the world's tricky, you know, the world's this and that. So, you know, basically, whilst you're here in this very short period of time, go and grab what you can. And in some ways, don't care about other people because they do it to you. And more fool you if you're not the first to go, you know. So, why be loyal in relationships if you want to go and sort of go and spread your wild oats and you want to go and go with all the different people, go and do it. You're only here once. It's about you anyway, and it's about your existence. So I've seen this with business people who get rich and they start making money. They start to really, like, they're adventurous. They buy yachts. They go to nightclubs, you know. They have girls around the world. They do things. They go skiing. They do loads of projects. They basically turn into like a big kid again. And it's all in the adventurous spirit. It's making money, spending money, you know, bulldozing around. And it's very highly attractive because you look at it and you think, wow, there's almost like a kid with money. You know, someone who's actually doing things in the world and going for stuff and a bit of free abandonment, you know. But ultimately, you know, like if it was a father, as much as you wouldn't want to be a serious father and that's your only your job, it's equally, you wouldn't want to be a father that's never there because they're always off doing, putting themselves at the absolute priority all the time. And that's what she's getting at. It's like these kind of action hero figures, you know, these that go off on their own adventures for their own sake. And she said that you're not really helping other people doing that.
And in that sense, she was actually really quite critical of Nietzsche, yeah. You know, and yeah. his notion of the child and everyone should be aiming for that and then ultimately becoming Übermensch or Overman or the Superman, yeah. You know, the different ways you can term yeah. it. Because you are, as the adventurer, you are basically, you're trampling on other people's freedoms. Yeah. For the sake of your own enjoyment, which to de Beauvoir meant, well, you're still not free. You can't possibly genuinely be free yeah. unless you also will the freedom of other people.
Yeah, I've come across adventurers and they're always like, you know, like, what are you doing though? They almost blame you for not being ambitious enough. It's, oh, you must have got a boring life though. Oh, is that all you do? You know, you should be doing this, you now. You should go on to this. You should be, you know, and because that's what they think life's all about, that. So obviously it's good because they're filling up their existence, they're filling up this future we talked about with loads of projects and loads of things. But underneath the surface, they are quite selfish people, probably find it hard to settle down if it's happening in your 20s, if it's still going on into your 30s and 40s and 50s, you know, there's probably some issues there because ultimately you are an individual, but you also are, you do live for yourself and you live for others. So you are an individual and you're part of a system as well. You won't get very far in the world if you couldn't connect with other people. The trouble is when you've got loads of money or you've got a lot of power, people will just serve you and support your adventures anyway because they're feeding off you. So possibly true connection there, you know, doesn't necessarily sort of exist if you're sort of, you know, paying all your friends to be your friends, you know? it's not the same, is it? You know, as genuinely having friends.
She links it as well to oppression. So remember, you know, again, the time it was written, post-World War II, etc. She's looking at, you know, how these dictators and tyrannical regimes can take power. She did see it as, if you're just this adventurer and all your freedom is being had at the expense of others, essentially you are being oppressive. You are participating in oppression. So it very much is, it's selfish, it's hurting others to achieve your own fulfillment. And for De Beauvoir, that just doesn't work. You know, it's not, yeah, it's good that you're recognizing there's no absolute ready-made values, and then you're taking advantage of that and you're kind of pursuing personal projects, but ultimately,
yeah,
you're not a genuinely free person.
Yes, his fault, the adventurer's fault, is believing that one can do something for oneself without others, you know, and also that he knows since he talks about himself a lot, often in books, you know, or magazines, that they have a real need for approval, but ultimately are forgotten and detested deep down by others for being selfish of their own existence. And perhaps without his knowing it, it seems so precious to him life seems so precious to him because of others, but never comes to realize that. So, you know what I mean? It's like, while you're busy fulfilling yourself and your own little my needs and my ambitions, my pleasures, my moments, you're actually, what you really, really would be wanting underneath is to be connected to people. But you've isolated people because you've trodden over them in a way, whether that's through not being around or giving them time or putting their needs before your needs or helping them. You know, this is where she started to criticize the adventurer that way, that it was too, way too selfish, self-indulgent.
Do you not think, though, or how do you think that does link to elite sport then? So obviously that's the field that you're predominantly, yeah, you're being in. Because to me, it's like, well, to be an elite athlete, there's no way around it. You have got to be pretty flipping selfish, and you've got to be pretty much self-obsessed, because everything's about following your path and doing what you need to do to get to the top, which is, it's kind of like the adventurer, really, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the passionate man's next, which is you know, a bit of a healthier way to do it. But I think the adventurer is, yeah, as an athlete, you've been, perhaps you're coming to the end of your career, maybe, and you've been so used to everything being about you, you know, unless you've been in a team and all the things as well, but still individual contracts and your reputation, you're a bit of a figure to everyone. So you could, if you're too serious and you've got too serious in that role, you're going to struggle anyway, you know, when you retire, because you don't know anything else. You've not diversified. So if you've become an adventurer and you've dominated and you've spent your money and everybody likes you because you're quite, you know, you're famous and you do this and you do that, then when you retire, it should almost be like a natural thing where then it's like, it's not about me anymore. But if you can't make that leap, if you're looking for that one last big victory to get that adulation again, you know, if as long as I'm a professional, everybody looks after me, they all serve me, you know, and I can do what I want and I can make demands, and even emotionally, you know, if I win, you're all happy. If I lose, we should all be sad, you know. I see a little bit of that, you know, in sort of, from the outside looking in, with someone like Andy Murray or something, you know, where he's obviously still playing tennis and he looks like he really wants to do it for his own, like, reasons, like he did when he was 18. There doesn't seem to be any kind of like, oh, well, I still play a bit of doubles and I've got other things to do now. You know, I'm looking after my kids and setting up a few things. Now, they might come in time, but at the moment, it just seems still stuck in, like, it's all about me, my winning a tennis match. And I see that with players. I see it when they're coming to the end of their careers. If they've been a bit too off believing their own hype and too looked up to, and they've nothing, no other strings to their bow, and that's all they've ever been loved for in many ways and known for, they've been a bit of a leader because they've been, you know, pushing the boundaries a lot, then they're not very comfortable with things not being about them anymore. So they kind of hang on as long as they can, and then even might then, when they start become some sort of controversial kind of character. So it still kind of has to be about them, even if it's bad news. You know what I mean? It's like they don't kind of grow old gracefully in that way and like transition out of everything being just about them.
Well, I texted you earlier about, there's a documentary about Jordan Henderson, the Liverpool captain, right, that I said. And it's interesting because I was very much watching it thinking, he is like ticking the boxes of the passionate man. But I said to you earlier as well, I was like, I do struggle a little bit to distinguish between the passionate man and the adventurer as like another step on. So De Beauvais, she sees the passionate man as like the inverse of the adventurer and a bit closer to genuine freedom, but still not quite there. And the way that I've interpreted it or kind of got it in my notes is where they're still very much, they're in a quest to possess that, what it is that they're doing, but there's probably less, there's less trampling on other people to get there, if that makes sense. Or maybe there isn't. Maybe they are still kind of treating other people as ways to achieve their own goals and freedom, I suppose. How do you distinguish them? Or how do you see it as an extra step on the passionate man?
I think the passionate man is a bit like, there's some links with the serious man, because it's like getting into one area, whereas the adventurer goes across many things. Although we just talked about sport, you know, and that's where.
But there may be project to project, you know, whatever like shines brightest at that moment, they'll jump.
Adventurer seems to be like, let's just get out in the world and be an adventurer and get into anything. Let's do it on my terms when I want to do it. And the sort of here, there, and everywhere. So that's where it is a bit like the sport thing was a bit difficult to say, because like someone like Andy Murray is only into one thing. So he could be more of a passionate man, because the passionate man is where you are, you're not serious and like the whole world should be a tennis player. You're just into your little project. So I'm really into, for example, say I'm really into my squash or whatever. Right, okay. Or you might be a DJ and you're really into your music. You're so passionate. You really, really, that's what you live for, really. That's your thing. Now, you don't think that that's for everybody, but so you're not going around anyone you meet who isn't into it. You're not thinking, well, you're into the wrong thing. I can't believe, you know, you're into cookery. You should be into music. So the passionate man still goes after projects. And in a way, it's like a golden cage. It's gold, it's shiny, it's passionate, it's great. But ultimately, you are nothing without it. You've gone so deep into it. You know, you could be an academic that's so academic that you can't be not an academic. You know, you can't just go and do other things. So it's like something takes over you through the passion. So you could, you know, that can be anything. You can get into something. Like you could do a PhD and it just basically takes over. You're passionate about it. You love it. But that's where it could consume everything that you do. So that's the thing with the difference.
But I suppose that the main difference then is that they at least appreciate that passion is subjective. So just because you're into squash doesn't mean I have to be into. You can easily appreciate that I might think squash is ridiculous, and you know, that doesn't bother you, or you don't.
No, you don't think it's the best thing in the world. You just think it's the best thing for me. So you're just you're a bit obsessed with it. You know, you. Now that can be useful, you know, at least you have a passion, you know, but can you see how it narrows ambiguity down? If you're into your fishing and it's all you ever do, you buy fishing gear, watch fishing programs, go fishing all the time. It's like, well, you are denying life's ambiguities because you've filled it up with just this passionate one thing. And that could be a great way to live, you know, and that's it. But De Beauvoir, again, your criticism was that that's fine, but you're still not accepting that you can't just go and hide in that all the time. There's a broader, more ethical, moral life is to do something like that, but also leave room for other people. So it might be that you were a fisherman, that you're into your fishing, that you open up a youth club for young people, or you become a member of that. And then because you open the youth club in fishing, then you might open a youth club in your local community just to help kids. She would then say, well, that's diversifying a little bit more, spreading your wings, helping you know, society a little bit more where you can. You still have a passion for the thing you have a passion for, and it's really floats your boat, but it doesn't own you. You know, it doesn't if you can't do it for about 6 months or whatever because of lockdown or whatever, you're not like shriveling up in your house like, I can't live because I've not got my fix. It's like, well, okay, time to do some other things. I'll always have a passion for that, but I just can't do it at the moment, so that's okay. Do you know what I mean?
That basically leads us to what she saw as the genuinely free man. So those five caricatures that we've just described, she saw those as these are the ways that we almost hide from our freedom. Yeah. And to be, so for her, genuine freedom she says, takes the excitement of the adventurer and the passion of the passionate man. And basically what you then do is you're including the concern for other people and other freedoms. So clearly in the five, the scale of five, the adventurer and the passionate man are closest to freedom. But she says to get to that end point, you've got to add a concern for others. So to will oneself free is also to will others free. And a free man is one whose end is the liberation of himself and others. That's a little bit, I think that's a good example you just gave there, like the with your fishing youth club that you've now set up in the community. That for her is perfectly that, isn't it? So you're still taking your excitement of the adventure where you're buzzing for your fishing and you're really passionate about it and you want to be good at it and you want to, you know, you might even be one of the best in the world at it. But you've now made that available to others and you're bothered about them having the chance to appreciate that and maybe get into it and experience the benefits of it. So you've not only willed yourself free, you've also willed the others, other people free at the same time. And that for de Beauvoir was genuine freedom.
Yeah, and that's recently, like we say, become a dad, and I'm passionate, I'm enthusiastic, I have my projects, you know, I like doing things, but I've noticed that now you when for me becoming a dad, it's like realizing that not everything is just about me first and my needs and what mood I'm in, how it's going to affect me. It's like, no, the first and most important thing now is really his freedom into the world, his journey in. I'm secondary slightly to that.
He doesn't care. He's a child. He still thinks you're a god. Yeah. He still thinks everything you say is right and true.
I know. He's not bothered, is he? But my it's a strange feeling because it's like, you know, being an older sort of parent as well, like being 47 and getting that at this point, I have led quite a selfish life, really. And it has, I've probably been the passionate one, really. Passionate man, I'd say, and the serious person as well at times. But mainly that, never really, not so much the adventurer, maybe elements of it. Never really been nihilistic, never really been the sub person. You know, I've always been out there trying to get things going. But definitely the last 20 years, passionate and so on. But ultimately recognizing and getting a sense that it's always about me and how it ends up, you know, affecting me. And I'm not going all communal. I'm definitely not setting up youth clubs and all these things or being all suddenly all, as long as other people are happy, I'm not bothered. But I've just felt a little move towards that. Like, it's kind of like acceptance as well as things of that the world acts on me. So there's almost like, let's not want control of everything all the time. I think all those caricatures are so frightened of the ambiguity that you try to act on the world. You try and control the world all the time, every little angle. You try and use your intelligence to make sure that everything just kind of goes your way, because you can do that with your freedom. But I think when you learn how to like allow the world to act back on you, and that's okay a little bit, and in the meantime you're going to help other people a little bit cope with their ambiguities, you tend to go with it a bit more flow. There's a bit less resistance. And that's where it feels quite a bit of a relief for everything not to be about me, and that I have to, you know. So this is it, you know, the childhood nostalgia of not having to create your destiny all the time, you know. Maybe I do and am feeling elements of the nostalgic child feeling again, because maybe I am realizing I am small and irrelevant after all. Do you know what I mean? And maybe that's a nice feeling. Maybe it is in some ways the dissolution of the ego or whatever it is, and maybe it is, you know, we're all going to need each other as we're getting older. So it's not a calculated move like, shit, I better start helping people because I'm going to need to be helped. But
I can definitely see that with Leo. So yeah, as a parent or as a father, because it's interesting, de Beauvoir and Sartre never had children, did they? So it's quite interesting that she, you know, ended up getting to this point and thinking this and writing about it, not having kids. Because I can totally see it as a dad now. How you would almost, it just makes it clear, and you can put that energy into Leo in a way, I suppose. Because it's like, it's not just all about me. I've got someone else who is literally reliant on me.
I've had my fun. I still love having my fun. I want to win things. I want to do things. I'm still buzzing. I don't like that to go wrong. I want this. I can still be moody, blah, blah, blah. But I've had my sort of adventures, if you will, my passion and all of that. I'm still going to be my personality, but it's not just about me anymore. And that's a relief. That's like a nice kind of like letting go. So that feels a little bit more like the child, actually. It's like there is ambiguity in the world. You can't control everything. I wish you could, because, you know, that we'd all want that. But I could get ill. Bad things could happen, you know, things won't always go my way. I'm not going to be a perfect person. I'm not going to write a Nobel Prize type level thing. I'm not, you know, I've done a lot of good things. I've done a lot of bad things. I'm mediocre. I don't think I'm that special. Whereas I think when you're coming up through your years and you're ambitious and you're serious or whatever it is, all those things, I think you're always trying to deny the ambiguity by getting control of your situation. And this is where Simone de Beauvoir's book, this book in particular, and these things, of all the existential stuff I've read and all the podcasts we've done so far, this is the stuff I use the absolute most with players. Even though they don't know that I'm using it with them, I'm kind of can tell where they've gone a little bit, and I empathise with them. I know that they got too serious, or that they're getting nihilistic, or that the passion's taken over them, and they can't see anywhere else. So I try and direct them back into a more for others balance at times. In other words, I try to help them get over themselves. You can get stuck up your own backside pretty quickly, you know. And rather than having to go to a spiritual retreat, you know, for 3 years and live in a forest or whatever, or a monastery, I just try and constantly help them in subtle ways to help them get over themselves and to help them appreciate themselves and to almost get them back to the child. But they'll never, you know, you can't. I appreciate that they've got all this ambiguity on their plate. And they think they're a good player, then they think they're a bad player. They think they're past it, but then they think that they can still do a lot in the future. They think they're really a good. They think that they can improve certain elements of the game, but only so far. And there's all these tensions going on. They feel like they're optimistic and yet they're pessimistic. There's all these dualities going on all the time. Obviously, as well by the nature of winning and losing and all the moods that are going on in life. So we always have good days and bad days as well, and based on those days and things happening, that can always change the way you feel about other people as well. And so it's complex, you know. It's not like you just exist in these caricatures and that's it, but by understanding them and listening to this podcast and going and investigating it yourself, you can give yourself a little bit of an understanding about the sort of tricks that you get up to try and make yourself feel better. But de Beauvoir was ultimately saying, never forget to get over yourself a bit and will the freedom of others. It's always nice to be a nice family member. It's always nice to do things for people. It's always nice to not think that you are the center of the universe all the time. So I will say to players a lot, can we just have a few days where you are not the star of your own life movie and what's going on in your film? The story of me and my important life. Can you just jump out of that for a minute and just be of service to other people? You know, it really helps people. And I think when you watch The Jungle and people, when they go off on these adventures or retreats and they go into like even the television, I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here, they're always confused about why they've had such a good experience in such strange, squalid conditions. And I think it's partly that they've had to just become a bit of a jump out of their personality, you know, their external role that they've built up. They're normally celebrities, so they're probably serious or passionate. And they basically got flatlined back to, we're all the same and we all need each other. And I think it must be liberating and freeing to just be accepted and to help other people and just to be enjoyed, because you help people basically and they basically help you back, you know. They're not the role anymore. Like Mo Farah, when he went in, he wasn't Mo Farah, the gold medalist. It was nice to mention it now and again, but ultimately he's a guy called Mo who has to bring the water every day.
Well, that must be why they can get through the ridiculous challenges, because it's like, I've got to do this so that the group can eat that night, isn't it, usually? They're willing to put themselves through brutal, like, yeah, stuff that you would never do in a million years in your everyday life.
Yeah, 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 because there is a thing that ultimately, you know, more, for a lot of people, motivation, you'll do more for others than you will do for yourself. We see that a lot with, you know, and not that that's necessarily a good thing, still think you've got to live for yourself. This isn't, de Beauvoir was saying the way out of ambiguity is to go full on for others all the time. She's still at a, you're still for self and you're still for others. But she said just what most people do is they just, most people go into the selfish, self-indulgent, and they can't get out of their own heads. They're thinking about their own problems all the time. So possibly a lot of the well-being issues going on are basically people overthinking their own importance, their own existence. It's like, you know, it's not just that, but just a general thing is, might be that, yeah, you're not having a good time, it's not really about me, is it, all the time? It's about other people as well. They need me. I'm part of a group. It's not just about what I'm experiencing. It's about how I'm helping people or making them feel, and that's cool. So that you know, we've looked a lot at the Adam Curtis's documentaries, haven't we, about the century of the self and the psychological effects of capitalism and the century, the 20th century, being so much about you, you're worth it, you can do it, you can dream, you can have goals, you can be this, you need to drive on, all the positive psychology stuff about making it and climbing and being something more, fine, but it has a kickback, doesn't it? Because it makes you very self-centered in your psychology. And I do, like we're saying, I do think athletes, you know, especially athletes, you know, you can eat this, you can sleep better, you can train this. Everything's put on them to be, because you can be somebody. And it must be difficult for them to be like, I don't want it to be about me for a bit. And what the athletes that I talk to or see or observe who can get that balance better, they're into it, but they can also take themselves less seriously and they can play around and they can do other things. They seem to have an overall sort of better level of mental well-being, I think, through the sports, because they don't take themselves too seriously or they're not too self-obsessed. And the people around them can help that.
And I definitely think this, so these five people that she's come up with here, de Beauvoir, I think that this can help with that as well. So we're not saying that this is written in stone and these are really objective, you know, you can tick these boxes and that's what you are at this point. They're just little guidelines, I think, that can help people just reflect on probably different aspects of their life as well. You know, I think you're right. These are quite fluid, so you're going to switch between them in different contexts, in different people that you're with, different stages in your life, so different ages, obviously. You're going to kind of move between
them.
But I think everyone could look at these, and I definitely recommend getting the book and reading it. Like I said at the start, it's pretty short. You know, you can read it in an afternoon. She does write a lot more. It's a lot easier to read than your Nietzsche's and your Heidegger's and people like that we've talked about, and Sartre as well to some extent. It's a lot more reader friendly.
Yeah,
but you could read it and really kind of go, actually, yeah, that's when I'm definitely more like this when I'm there, and I'm maybe too much like this at the moment. And it's just a useful, I think, like a reflective, not framework, but just a bit of a structure to guide some of your reflections really on just how you're going about your life.
I think one of the areas I noticed it in was, like, you know, I work with coaches, and I think a lot of my modern coaches, with all the information you get and all the, you know, the right and the wrong and all the, you know, like Twitter and all these things, I do think a lot of people have got serious. I see a lot of coaches, you know, and even our students who used to teach, they're very serious, can't have a laugh. And that to me is not that they're not funny or they can't use humor, or it just means that they're taking themselves like, you know, these are the 12 commandments of coaching and you won't catch me missing one out. I know how to do this. You know, a lot of the academics that we see and know, you know, and we see on commenting on Twitter and doing things, you know, a lot of them are quite, you know, I am right. You know, this is right. And you're like, well, I get your argument, but it doesn't mean, you know, just lighten up a bit, have a bit of humor around it. You know, you're not necessarily, you're not necessarily helping athletes that you're working with, because they're already passionate and serious. You know, they must have been bringing that. It's not going to help the situation by you being more stuck up your own backside with that face on and all. You know, I think it's a job of a helper or a parent or teachers, coaches, to actually bring some lightness. I think that's one way you can help others. to bring a bit of fun and humor to kind of to, you know, just in the way you are. I think we can all be suffer from that of being too glum and strict.
Well, I actually get that from another good thing about de Beauvoir is because she's a bit more contemporary. You know, she was around until the mid 80s. There's quite a lot of stuff on YouTube of her, so you can actually listen, watch her on interviews, speaking in English a lot of the time as well. And I got a sense from her that she has got a bit of a twinkle in her eye.
Yeah, she's fun, yeah.
She had that, but she didn't take herself too seriously, you know. There's quite a bit of laughter in her interviews, and she'll mock herself as well in some of this stuff, and, you know, maybe stuff that she'd written in the past. So I got that from her. So even if you don't want to just read the book, I'd just have a search for her on YouTube and just watch some of her stuff, because I got that from her, a bit more lighthearted, serious philosophy, but a bit more lighthearted with it, and not, she wasn't stood there going, I am a genius, you know, bow to my feet of the wisdom that I'm giving you here. It was very much like, oh, well, yeah, I wrote that, and, you know, there's some good bits in it, but I don't know what I was talking about there. It was a bit funny kind of thing.
Absolutely, and they were into the parties, weren't they, and so on, those people, And I do think that, what you know, if you read At the Existentialist Cafe by Sarah Bakewell, that's a good little lighthearted read into these existentialists and what they were going on about and what they thought. And you get a bit of a biography as well about how they lived. And they were quite free-spirited, but you know, they get their heads down. So, yeah, it was they were living embodiments of what they were talking about as well.
Yeah.
I think that's a really important point when you're being a philosopher or you're trying to be philosophical. It's also how you are is as important as what you say, you know, and that's you know, if anyone listening to this is thinking, oh gosh, some of this is good, maybe don't go start telling everybody about it, but actually just change the way you are and act, and almost like let them know it through the way you are being.
Live it, yeah.
Rather than just ramming it down the throats, coming across as all intelligent. And all you've done is what we've done, which is just nick other people's ideas and pass them off as your own.